Hello and welcome to Euractiv's Agri-Food Podcast. I'm Natasha Foote.
And I'm Gerardo Fortuna.
And here's your weekly update on all things agriculture and food in the EU from Euractiv's Agri-Food News Team.
Our top story this week is actually an interview that we're going to do. But just a bit of background before talking with our guests. So basically there was this conference last week, the third European conference on Xylella fastidiosa. Xylella fastidiosa is...
You say that very well. You sound like a scientist.
Of course, I mean, the scientist of the couple is actually Natasha. But
here we go again.
yeah. So basically, this is a pest. It's a bacteria, actually, but of course, it's a pest of the that is mostly affecting olive trees in the Mediterranean areas. But we will talk about this with our guests. At the same time, I also have to announce that we have an exclusive clip.
I can't tell you, by the way, for everyone listening, how excited Gerardo has been for this exclusive. It's a big deal.
Yeah. So let's start the interview first, and then we're going to listen to something very, very exclusive.
What a teaser.
Yeah. So our first guest today is Maria Saponari from the Institute for Sustainable Plant Protection, a branch of Italy's National Research Council, which is the biggest public research institution in Italy. Thanks, Maria, for being with us. So, Maria, can you tell us a bit more about this Xylella bacterium?
Xylella fastidiosa is a plant pathogenic bacterium already well known as the causal agent of severe diseases on crops in several American countries. What makes this pathogen particularly dangerous is its ability to infect hundreds and hundreds of plant species. And in fact, the latest update of the database in which all the susceptible host plants are listed account for more than 500 plant species that can succumb to the infection caused by this bacterium. Indeed, the bacterium can be spread in the crops by a multitude of insect species. We call them vectors or carrier of the bacterium. So these two aspects together make the management program to control the disease caused by this bacterium very complex, as we need to tackle several plants and several insect species.
And can you give us an idea of what the situation in Europe is right now, and you know which areas are the most affected?
This pathogen in Europe emerged only recently. It is in fact considered an exotic pathogen introduced recently on the EU territory. It was discovered for the first time in southern Italy when in this part of Europe a deadly olive disease appeared in the region of Apulia and raising major concerns. Investigation on this disease unfortunately revealed that these olive trees were infected by Xylella. And after this finding, mandatory programs to survey all the territories in Europe, so all member states started specific programs to search for this pathogen, led to discover outbreaks in several southern Europe areas, like in Corsica, in mainland France, in Spain, in the Balearic Island, and most recently in Portugal.
And it's actually interesting because, how do you monitor the spread or the penetration of this pathogen?
We monitor the pathogen with a molecular test, with a diagnostic test. And I have to say that as sequencing is currently an important tool to investigate the variants of SARS-CoV-2 in the pandemic we unfortunately are experiencing, The same is for Xylella. And in Europe, we conducted a massive sequencing campaign in cooperation with the US. And from that, we could retrieve important information on the pathway of introduction in Europe. And therefore, we could improve then the controls and the checks at the port of entry in Europe, as well as we could date back when this introduction of the bacterium occurred in Europe. And therefore, we could understand better the evolution under the condition that occur in Europe and predict the future progression of the infection in our areas.
And can you tell us a little bit more about, I mean, you mentioned already, but exactly what kind of plants are affected by this right now and could be in the future?
For sure, olive is surely the most affected crop with the epidemic situation in southern Italy. In the other outbreaks that I mentioned before, the situation is much more severe. We say that we are facing more an endemic spread of the pathogen rather than an epidemic like in southern Italy. Overall, in these outbreaks, more than 70 plant species are affected, but the most important are for sure olive and almond. I have to say that we have also detected in Europe and in the Balearic Island in particular some strains that are known to be severe on grapes. But fortunately, these strains are restricted to the Balearic Island, and under the conditions occurring in the island, they do not cause major damage on the vineyard so far.
So thanks for this introduction. And actually, the reason why we invited you in this podcast is to talk a bit more about this research project, the X. I don't know if it's X Factors or XF Actors. Anyway, there was also this conference with together with the European Food Safety Agency. So can you tell us a bit more about this research project and also on its main outcomes?
In Europe, before the first finding in 2013 of Xylella fastidiosa in olives in southern Italy, there was no research program investigating or specialized on this pathogen. So thanks to the European Commission with the H2020 program, they first supported the project Ponte and then XF Factors, which represented the seed for a well-integrated network of multidisciplinary research teams that all worked together to gather important knowledge on the pathogen and the interaction with the European and Mediterranean crops, flora, and environment. In the framework of the project, we have developed the knowledge on the different European outbreaks, mainly identified which are the plants that are most susceptible to the strains that of the bacterium that we detected in Europe. And then another important activity has been predicting the future scenario in Europe, and so modeling the spread and validating the approach of remote sensing, which are two important aspects to help phytosanitary authorities to better plan the surveillance of their territories. We have also evidence that some crop species are immune or resistant to the bacterium. And this is an aspect very important for those areas where the pathogen is particularly aggressive, like in southern Italy, because these plant species can be used to restore and regenerate the agriculture in these areas that currently are completely destroyed. Then another important aspect tackled by the project are the insect vectors, the so-called spittlebug. We know a lot now about the lifestyle of these insects, on which plants they prefer to feed. So with all this information, we can better plan interventions to reduce their population, and so to reduce the spread of the bacteria.
And talking about the spittle bug, I mean, we often speak about integrated pest management, and it seems this concept is very difficult to apply to this bug, this main kind of bacteria carrier. So why is this so difficult?
Spittle bug in the past have never been attentioned by the scientists or farmers or growers as pests, because actually they are harmless to plants. They do not cause any significant damages. Unfortunately, they proved to be carrier of the bacterium. So in the area where coexist the bacterium, they are highly attentioned because they are the responsible for the spread of the bacterium. And the difficulties in the management is that this class of insects are very polyphagous, so they can feed and live on different plants, and they have low capacity to perceive volatiles or pheromones. This implies that strategies that generally are used for other pests, like trapping using attractants or pheromones, in this case have low or no efficacy at all. So we had to search for alternative strategies.
And I mean, we have this clip, and we are about to listen to the serenade of these spittle bugs. Can you describe what we're going to hear and how you managed to record it and how this could be used?
Yeah, since this class of insect does not use chemical signals to communicate within the population, between the specimen, between the individuals, but they mainly use vibrational and acoustic signals, and these kind of signals are important for the mating of these insects. So the research team of the Foundation Edmund Mach from Trento in Italy has investigated and recorded under laboratory conditions the signals that the insects exchange during mating. So for the first time in the framework of the activity of the project, we deciphered the male call and the female playback, and with the hope that in the future, artificial reproduction of these signals may help, for example, to disrupt mating and so therefore reduce the insect population in the crops.
And I just have a last question. So do you think this kind of knowledge that you're using for treating this insect can also be transferred to other pests as well, hypothetically?
Yes, because nowadays we are developing strategies with reduced use of chemicals. And so using this kind of stimuli, like acoustic or vibrational stimuli, can be used also in other insects to help the environmentally sustainable strategies for their control.
So now is the much-awaited moment.
The moment you've all been waiting for, and no one more so than Gerardo.
Indeed. So as we said during the interview, we're talking about the serenade. It's the mating call. I mean, it's not the actual...
Where are you going with that?
...copulation. It's...
the bit before.
Because our listeners are not watching this. And, you know, from the sound, they might think it's inappropriate content. But actually, we're here to hear this serenade of this spittle bug.
The spittle bug serenade. It's quite nice.
Indeed. We celebrate love in this podcast in all forms. And let's listen to this clip.
So I have to say, when I listened to this clip, firstly, I actually really enjoyed it. I didn't think it was going to sound as cool as it did.
It's amazing.
It's incredible. But also, I really did feel like it's really, you know, not out of place in a rave scene. I feel like this could be a new genre of music. I mean, I went to university in Bristol University, and you know, they were big on these alternative nights, and I just feel like if I played this music, I mean, this serenade, it would not be out of place.
You're giving our listeners also the background. No, you know, you're in Bristol and
telling my life story.
This rave party.
Back when I was cool, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Mm. Before joining Euroactive. Really, I'm speechless. It's tough, but I'm speechless.
I've never known you speechless. This is the first. This is an exclusive and a first on the same podcast. Incredible.
In other news, there's, I mean, we're moving from an insect to another. There was another important news this week, which is about the first edible insect whose marketing authorization was approved by the member states. It's the yellow mealworms. And we have another guest to talk about this.
So here with us today, we have Christophe Derrien, who is the Secretary General of IPIF, the International Platform of Insects for Food and Feed, who's going to tell us a little bit more about this new authorization of this mealworm. So the EU approved its first ever edible insect this week for marketing authorization. It was a yellow mealworm. And I'm wondering, could you tell us, I mean, how are these mealworms actually used? Like, what products could we find them in?
Mealworms are part of these few edible insects which can be used either as a whole product, so you can find those as a snack, or you can also find those sometimes in pasta or in other dishes. So either you find them as a whole animal, or you can also find them as a powder. And this powder can be incorporated in a various range of products, ranging from biscuits, food supplements, or burgers. These are a few examples of the products which can be based on insects, and notably yellow mealworm. So the product is very versatile. Many different uses are possible.
And the next question is actually, why should consumers be interested in eating insects? I mean, what benefits does eating insects offer, either nutritionally or in terms of sustainability?
So you've actually touched upon the two main elements, let's say, or the two main credentials or benefits associated with the consumption of insects. One is the healthy elements. So insects are very rich in protein, numerous vitamins, including notably vitamin B12. Insects and insect-derived products are also very rich in fatty acids, which are essential for the populations, and notably for elderly people or for people who have high physical activity. A lot of benefits associated from benefits associated with the use of insects from a nutritional point of view, but also looking at on the environmental part. So insects and insect-derived products have lower carbon footprint than the majority of products that we are consuming, and the meat-derived products. Products can be or would very well fit as a complementary source of proteins, meat, or other vegetable based. But insects, or at least in the next few years, we are not forecasting insects and insect-derived products to replace meat as such, but rather to complement those products. And considering that in Europe, we are forecasting that the consumption of meat might slightly decrease, let's say that those... So this meat that you wouldn't eat in the future, that meat or that quantity of meat could very well be replaced by insects.
Mm. And you've actually touched upon my next question there, because I'm wondering what is the appetite actually like for eating insects in the EU? You know, are consumers open to this kind of idea, favorable to the idea of eating insects?
Progress can be made in the sense, like, I think now if you look at the figures, market studies, there is very few of those products which are being consumed at European level. One of the reasons is because those products are not today authorized in all EU countries. That's one element. consumers might not necessarily be aware of all those benefits associated with the consumption of insects. I've touched upon some of those before. And what we're noticing is that there is, at least in Europe, growing interest from consumers around the impacts of food that we are eating. Tell those consumers all those benefits that are associated with the consumption of those products. We would expect, let's say, the consumption of insects to grow quite rapidly. Also, we have to mention the fact that there are already a couple of niche or specialized markets for insects as food. I've mentioned before, I think, sports nutrition, food supplements. These are a few of those niche markets which currently exist. And with this first novel food, insect novel food authorization expected in the next few weeks, and the new ones or the following ones to come up in the next few months, we expect those markets, those specialized markets, to grow very rapidly in the future.
The last question is also on, the buzz about the potential that insects hold as a food product. And we talk about this right now. But I mean, there's less attention on the role that insects could play as animal feed. You know, maybe you could tell us a bit more about this. Are feedstuffs likely to include insects in the future? What benefit it offers? And is there, you know, any movement on this issue?
Well, actually, the use of insects for animal feed is a reality today in Europe. So a couple of feed manufacturers are already incorporating insect proteins, notably for feed intended for aquaculture animals, as well as for pet food. The reason for that is that those two markets are those currently authorized in the European Union. However, as you might be aware, we're expanding those uses to be extended to a few other species, and notably to poultry and pigs, because the European Union is expected to authorize the use of insect proteins for those two animal species at the end of the summer, or after the summer 2021. That's already a reality in animal feed. The quantities that are being produced remain relatively limited today. This is due to the fact that, as you can easily imagine, the sector is relatively new, still to some extent in its infancy. So we don't have all the, at least in Europe, the production capacities remain relatively limited today, but the sector is growing massively and very rapidly. And coming back to your first question about the benefits associated with the use of those products in animal feed. So for those species in which the product is already authorized, notably aqua feed and pet food, there are nutritional benefits associated with the use of those products, notably when it comes to helping the animals to grow rapidly. And also there are a lot of studies demonstrating the functionality benefits of those products in the animal feed and for those particular species. To be more specific, in the case of insect products, many of those products, and notably the fat or the chitin from the insects, have antimicrobial properties, which are beneficial, of course, for those animals. And also there are some studies showing the hypoallergenicity potential of those insect species which are used in animal feed. And that is notably relevant in the case of pet food animals. So if you want to feed your dog or your cat with highly nutritious materials and with products which are good for his or her health, incorporating insect proteins in their ratio is a very reliable and very interesting solution.
And we move to the latest story of our podcast. It was a busy week, we can say that.
Yeah, there's lots going on this week.
We can introduce this news with a quote, with a musical reference, as Sia used to sing. You shut me down, but I won't fall. I am titanium dioxide.
But this will fall, actually.
Yeah, this will fall. This will fall, indeed. Yeah, it's not like Sia sang. It's actually falling. Can you tell a bit more about this?
I have actually had this song in my head since I wrote this, but actually, I mean, it's actually a very serious topic. There's this this food additive called titanium dioxide that you may or may not have heard of. It's in a lot of products, a lot of food products, things like cakes and soups and broths and sauces, things
it's
like that.
It's everywhere, Natasha. It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. It's also in toothpaste. It's in cosmetics, sun cream, things like that. This basically makes things white. That's its kind of its sole purpose, at least as a food additive.
Its superpower.
Make things white. Yeah, yeah. That is its superpower. That's its yeah, exactly. It doesn't have any flavor, anything else. It's not technical for anything. It's just a some kind of white food colorant. And for years there's been this big debate over titanium dioxide, basically because it's made up of these really, really tiny particles, these nanoparticles. And there's been a concern that these nanoparticles can kind of find their way in, you know, through the natural protective barriers of the human body. So there's been a big debate. Actually, it ended up, we saw France actually banning the use of this food additive a couple of years ago. And we've been discussing, lots of people have been discussing this for the last over the last decade, basically. And this week, the European Food Safety Agency, EFSA, they released a new opinion about this. They had one opinion back in 2016, and then they've revised this, looked at new evidence, and they've released a new opinion which found that titanium dioxide is unsafe. So this is paving the way basically for an EU-wide ban on the substance. And this, as we said, it's everywhere. It's in so many things. So this is actually going to have a huge impact on the industry and how they're going to have to reformulate all of these products that this is in. So the reason that they concluded it was unsafe is basically because they couldn't rule out a concern for genotoxicity, which basically means, you know, the ability of a chemical substance to damage DNA, which then could lead to carcinogenic effects. There's thought that could have, you know, some cancer link potentially with this food additive.
And also something is moving because, I mean, it seems that the commission is actually...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, super quickly, is willing to propose a ban mm-hmm. of this titanium dioxide in the next weeks.
It's not imminent.
No, indeed.
Because it wasn't highlighted that it was, you know, it wasn't an acute health concern, so it wasn't imminent. But the commission's basically, they have said, they've confirmed that they will be proposing to member states that they should withdraw titanium dioxide from the union list of food additives. And there'll be this kind of transition period where there'll be a discussion between the commission and member states, you know, to kind of figure out how they're going to substitute this substance that, as we said, is everywhere.
I mean, after the proposal, this proposal needs the approval from the member state in the... It's actually in the standing committee that approved also the first insect. So the famous COPAF
comes back again.
Yeah. So, of course, we're going to cover this every development of this very interesting story.
So that's all from us this week. And this week, like every week, the Euractiv Agri-Food podcast was produced by Euractiv's Agri-Food news team. That's Gerardo Fortuna and Natasha Foot, with the help of Euractiv's podcast producer, Evie Chiori. And you can also find this podcast on all major streaming platforms, so that includes Apple, Amazon, Spotify, and Stitcher.
Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss the latest agriculture news from the EU. I'm Gerardo Fortuna. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.
This podcast is part of Euractiv's project Beyond Agriculture, funded by the IMCAP program of the European Union. The content of this podcast represents the views of the author only and is his, her sole responsibility. The European Commission does not accept any responsibility for use that may be made of the information it contains.